RF service for my automobile so that I can be traveling around and listening to the satellite at 1.6 gigahertz, and I compare those two audio streams, roughly how much difference do you think I might hear, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Unless you're a freaky nut like some of the people that I know that record music and record classical music and make CDs, you're probably not going to notice much of a difference. Okay, if you were a conductor, first of all, you probably wouldn't even want XM or Sirius because of the psychoacoustical compression. It'll drive you out of your mind, and I'll tell you why. It was a system that was kind of invented by Ray Dolby, of Dolby fame. And basically what this compression system says is that if it's that faint, you can't hear it, therefore I won't transmit it. Get the picture?
Oh, yeah. So the Dolby compression system, I think you're saying, makes a kind of a compromise that the average listener is not aware of. But a serious audiophile will hear the difference. The AGC pumping, so to speak. Or what is the actual nature of the difference that they hear, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, that's a bit of a story because there's something called Dolby A, Dolby B, Dolby C. Dolby E is what we use in the broadcast industry for carrying 8 tracks of audio for surround sound on a stereo PCM track so that we can put it on a tape machine or put it in a file and get it somewhere. We have something called AC3, which is the first generation of true psychoacoustical compression that your DVD player uses. The previous versions of Dolby do a certain amount of compression, companding, breaking the audio down into specific bands and interleaving that data together and omitting stuff that can be matrixed out, so that way you wind up with the original stuff. The Dolby AC3 and the various other different codecs that are used for satellite transmission, you cannot rematrix out all the original stuff. There's stuff missing. Okay, sounds great to you, but you got to consider what's dynamic range. When you go to Carnegie Hall, you go to Lincoln Center, you will be listening to a dynamic range that approaches on the order of 120 dB in terms of an orchestra. You don't get that in rock music. You don't get that in most normal stuff. Okay, when you're listening to Beethoven's Fifth, and that little triangle goes off in the back, and you're sitting in the back of the Lincoln Center, with the acoustics of that room, and you have good hearing, you will hear it. But the average person actually won't. So that's where the difference is.
KC2QIQ in the comment?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn. And Glenn, after you finish with your comment, try to explain to me the rationale for why the RF service is more expensive than the non-RF service. Because from my point of view, I'm buying the same service as far as what comes out of the loudspeaker is concerned. Over to you, Eric. Correction, Glenn.
Well, I guess the transmission or bandwidth through the satellites is probably costing them a premium, so you're paying a premium for satellite service. Where the internet service is low cost. I mean, it's just a bulk over-the-air stream service over the internet, which at this point in time seems to be where everything is going low cost these days. And you're already paying all the overhead, you know, you're already paying for your internet service, you're already paying for the router, you're basically just supplying a very simple connection where the satellite service is, satellite time is expensive, satellite bandwidth is expensive, so, it's just a more expensive way to go. That takes care of that. The other thing was agreeing with Eric as far as, if you're sitting at home like an audiophile and you're expecting XM radio to sound like a beautiful piece of perfect vinyl or a great CD through a real high-end system, I don't think that XM or a Sirius radio is going to do it for you. But when you're talking about an automobile, and you're driving along and you got road noise underneath the tires and you got the windows and the air conditioning going and everything else, it's superior to FM in my opinion because you don't lose the station. If you're going, let's say you're going to drive to Dayton, you can listen to the radio the whole way there and you don't lose the station. So there's a lot of benefits, I think, to it. But there again, it's not going to be, even the one in the satellite is not going to be perfect reception. To the point of the detail that Eric was talking about. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
If I'm driving to Dayton while listening to one of these satellite services, audio services, and I've chosen a route where I go through a tunnel, roughly how long am I in the tunnel before the audio fades? Go ahead.
Depends on the radio.
Yeah, I've had that, Dick, in some tunnels. I don't know what they do. I don't lose it. And other times, if you're driving underneath underpasses, I don't lose it either. But sometimes if I'm, like, in the right position at the right time, it will just blank out. So in other words, it will go off into a mute, which is actually not too terrible. It just goes quiet for a moment, and then it will come back, and you'll hear, nice clean radio again, as opposed to FM or AM, where you'll hear cracklies and static and drifting in and out and picket fencing, which is something you don't really get with XM or, Sirius radio.
I can explain that.
Yeah, go ahead. You said it depends on which radio. Give us some words on that one, Eric. You got it, Eric.
All right, first of all, when both systems were designed, they are dual receivers, okay? There is a set of frequencies allocated for satellite and a set of frequencies allocated for terrestrial. If you happen to be in a very populated area like New York City, there's also there's several terrestrial translators. There's one in Mineola. There's another one further out east. They're supposed to put one on a my tower, but they never did do that. That's because they were having money troubles at that point. There's one on Alpine Tower. So two things are going on. You have two sources of radio. If you actually go to the antenna positioning, the antenna strength indicator on most of the radios, you'll see two sets of bars, one for terrestrial, one for satellite. Let me make a drop. The other thing is, depending upon the model of the radio, because it's a digital stream, you can buffer it. Some of the radios will actually allow you to rewind what you've been listening to and hear it again. Some of the earlier radios have small buffers. The newer stuff have large buffers in them, where it will buffer 5 minutes, 6 minutes worth of audio before it runs out. Don't forget, you go under a tree with a lot of leaves on it, and you watch your signal strength indicator, it disappears. But if you're moving, you go into a tunnel. Oh, and by the way, there are some tunnels that have radiax in it that if carry cell service, and XM and Sirius have also paid to put their services on that too. So there's your answer, Dick.
Okay, with lots of buffering, I can be listening pretty far ahead as far as what's going into the downlink versus what's coming into... I live pretty far behind as to what's coming into the downlink versus what's coming out of the loudspeaker. But if I'm driving under a series of trees and that signal drops out for periods of time, and that's a one-way communication path from satellite to ground, how does the satellite receiver get a hold of the missing chunk of information while I was under that tree? Over to you, Eric.
They do this little trick. They actually interleave program packets. So, in essence, you can think of it as FEC, the form of FEC that they operate. And what the receiver does is says, oh, I'm missing packets number 12, 14, 16. And then I don't remember what the rate is. I think it's like every 30 seconds or every 60 seconds, they will actually have those interleaved packets there, which minimizes the effect. You go on to some place where you don't have reception, and when the receiver comes back, it's starting ahead of where you were. If it's only for a short period of time, you don't lose anything.
So since they have two communication paths, either two communication paths by way of the downlink from the satellite, or because of ground repeater systems, if one of the frequency ranges is 1.625 gigs for, we'll say, downlink from satellite to receiver into the automobile, what approximate is the frequency range of the terrestrial translator? Over to you, Eric.
I don't remember the exact frequencies. I can look it up. It's like only a megahertz away. It's not that far.
Okay, so If it's S-band on the RF link satellite to ground, it's also S-band 1.6 gigs. Or is that L-band? L-band on the terrestrial repeated frequency range. And they're just offset a little bit to not interfere with each other. Interesting. Now, Glenn, I've still got a problem. And that is, to the consumer, it's easy to explain that, yes, the RF link is much more difficult to establish by way of an expensive satellite and a lot of hardware to maintain as opposed to the internet link. That's a truism. But now that system is all thoroughly established. Lots of consumers are using the satellite link as they drive around with their automobile. I come along as a brand new subscriber, and whether or not they send the enabling code for my receiver by way of the internet link, or whether they say it'll send the enabling code through the RF link so that the satellite to ground comes into my receiver, the cost to them, for me, the additional subscriber, is identical. So I think you're telling me that the $10 extra price is really just an excuse for me to pay for the infrastructure, but in reality, the real cost to them to add me as subscriber number 10,521, really there is no differential. That's an opinion. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the second.
K2YO.
That's not true, and I'll tell you why, and you can offer pick up Bernie.
Okay, yeah. We're going to pick up Glenn, Eric, and Bernie in that order. Glenn, Bernie, and Eric. Glenn, go ahead.
I think what happens, Dick, is that there's a taxation issue with the two. And one is that they have to pay a certain amount to do that. There's infrastructure cost, and there's cost that gets pushed onto the consumer. So the way that the service gets taxed and billed onto the consumer, there is a difference between the internet and the over-air service. So there is a difference there. I bet you Eric has a much better explanation of it than I do. But let me pass it back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, what's your cat's name?
Bandit.
Good sounding animal. Bernie, K2YO, you got it.
You have to remember the price of the net based on the cost of materials. In the internet world, they have competitors, so they must have a lower price because they have price competition from other providers. If we're talking about satellite-based radio, there is no competition, so they can set their own price based on the primary FCC restriction. So you get a price based on what it costs you to build it, you price it based on what the market will bear.
Eric, KE2EJ, I wish you would say some words to Bernie. KE2EJ, you've got it.
Yeah, Bernie, turn the level on your microphone down. It's way too hot. It sounds really terrible. There's a couple of things going on here. One is competition, okay, as Glenn pointed out. But the other thing is, most people don't realize that the receivers are subsidized. When you go pay your $99 for the receiver, or the $69 or the $29, depending upon which receiver it is, you're actually buying a service, you're purchasing the receiver, but they're also subsidizing the cost of the receiver. DirecTV does the same thing. Well, all the other services, you know, work off of that particular model. That kind of business model has been around for a long time. The internet only receivers actually cost less, but there's also the competition issue for other services. Don't forget, these folks are trying to stay alive, and it is quite expensive to put birds up in the sky, and they actually now have to support two entirely separate different systems. One is geostationary, which is XM, and the other is a LEO, which is Sirius. So I'm going to run into the house. I'll catch you in a minute. K2RIW,
K2J. Wow. I wasn't aware that one was a GEO and the other's a LEO. Amazing. Did you want to repeat your message at 10 dB less audio, Bernie? I'm not sure anybody got anything out of it. It was so heavily distorted. K2IO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, is a test transmission. Is this any better?
About 5,000% better. I can actually recognize your voice now.
Very interesting. It's the exact same audio settings we had from last week when everybody complained about it being too low. Anyway, my comment is that the pricing of a product is never related to the cost of materials put into it. So in the internet world, you have competitive price pressure from other services, iTunes, number of streaming services that are free, so they've got to lower their price for that. In the area of mobile satellite reception, they have no competition. So their only real competition is what the FCC puts as a limit as to what they can charge.
Okay. So getting back to Eugene's original question. Eugene, I think that go ahead and do the experiment if you want to, trying to make a connection to your DirecTV 18-inch diameter dish. But because of the low noise block converter electronics that's located at the feed horn of that dish, which is tuned to 11 gigahertz and down converts from 11 gigahertz to roughly 1,000 megacycles, it is not, in my opinion, going to have any reasonable reception at the 1,600 megacycles of XM radio. There are a 1.6 gigahertz antenna is something you could homebrew. It wouldn't be very elaborate. Or you can go and spend $40 and buy one from Radio Shack, according to Eric. And maybe that's a simpler solution to get good, reliable reception at home. W2EWK for any other comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick. You answered all my questions, but I figured too, Dick. I thank you very much for coming back to me. But if I find something, you know, I'll let you know. But otherwise, I'd be still figuring out, you know, the antenna lengths and that stuff. And who knows? You never can tell. Okay, W2EWK.
Now, at around 9 o'clock, these particular classes, I'm calling it a school that Mel and Dick runs. I'm being complimentary to us, and I'm calling it a school, an RF school. We have both simple classes and complicated classes. We go to the classes that are dedicated more to the beginners, and if Mel is available, he'll tell us what kind of email from the group that's just learning how to all this stuff works, or what they would like to know. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Yes, this is K2KEY. All right. Yeah. I've gotten a lot of emails from a lot of young people that have gotten fascinated with our field of radio communications, electronics, etc. And they've been taking boards, they've been picking up all kinds of things and taking components off and sorting them and all that. Whole group busy. So sounds like the interest is growing, which I'm very pleased to hear. The comments now are that they've gotten a lot of components. I'm not sure what they are. They look like resistors and things like that. Making measurements and find very little resistance with them. I think they are about finding the little chokes and inductors that are on these boards. And I thought we could say some things about what these little devices are and what they can do with them, how to, you know, essentially use them. So with that, let's talk about now the next thing, which we've gone through all the resistors and capacitors and other odds and ends, and about use of small inductors that you'll find on a board like chokes. Over.
I have one set of opinions on this one, Mel, because of the environment I live in. I think you live in a slightly different environment. You're going to have a different set of opinions. So the guys are going to hear both. I do most of my work at frequencies above 100 megacycles and below 10,000 megacycles, and there the printed circuit boards use an awful lot of surface mount inductors, which are usually rated in nanohenries. Nano is 10 to the minus 9, so one nanohenry would be 10 to the minus 9 henry. It's 1/1,000,000th of a henry. That's what 10 to the minus 9 or nano means. And the markings on those surface mount inductors that I've used, let me drop, are different for each individual brand. It's not a color code of the normal sense. I mean, some of the brands, they'll have a green dot for one value, a red dot for another value, a white dot. It's just one single dot. And sometimes that dot is in different places on the actual surface mount component itself. So inductors are a bit of a mystery when it comes to the marking codes if you don't know that particular brand name. That's the environment I live in. And maybe you're living in an environment where the inductors are slightly larger and maybe they have a real color code or a real numbering system that's workable. When you put your leads across a unknown component that has at least one side removed from the printed circuit board, so at least one side is free, and you measure something extremely close to 0 ohms on the lowest scale of your ohm meter, either it's a dead shorted capacitor, that's a possibility, most likely it's not a resistor, high probability it is an inductor. Most of these miniaturized surface mount inductors have extremely small number of ohms, and therefore it takes different instrumentation or different techniques to measure their value or to find out the brand name and interpret the crazy marking system for how many nanohenry that particular inductor is. Let me pass it over to Mel first for a comment on that, and then we'll go to Wesley next. Mel, from the inductors that you've seen, I wonder if it's as bad as what I'm encountering. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Well, no, these are, like I say, they've been picking up a lot of boards, pulling them out of VCRs that were laying in a basement that they, the people, you know, parents, grandparents didn't have the nerve to throw out the item that cost them hundreds of dollars years ago. So they're taking these boards out of them, which I had suggested because they're very easy to unsolder the old boards with a lot of resistance and capacitors and everything. And the inductors are fairly straightforward, simple inductors. And a lot of them are just small, tubular, encapsulated RF chokes. So the reading on them usually is the standard, known as the standard readings. EIA codes and all, I think, are fairly standard on those little chokes. And I was going to give an example of what you may see, Dick, over.
Yeah, give us an example, Mel, of how it's marked, and is it henries, microhenries, nanohenries, and so on. And is it a numbering system, a coded system? So lucky for you, many of these RF chokes you're talking about are axial lead tubular objects, and I almost never see those in the work that I'm doing these days. Over to you, Mel.
Well, I'm talking about stuff that's going back a good number of years, because the way they describe the boards, mostly all a lot of discrete old, just plain bipolar transistors, and that will get to maybe in the near future of how they can identify some of these transistors. They all have little numbers on them. That's one way, of course, but how to make a little test on the transistors that they pull off the boards. I told them to sort everything aside. We're going to have a lot of little pieces, a lot of little devices that we'll be able to put together nice little projects in the future. Now, for instance, you'll find a lot of these little tubular RF encapsulated RF chokes used in a lot of the VCRs and TV sets, very small little axially type devices. And for instance, you may see something, take one, let me think offhand, let me think of something. Okay, you'll have the first color that may be like silver. That's the supposedly the mil spec identification. Silver, and then let's say, orange, and then say, let me drop. Trying this thing out. Let's say orange, after that, another orange, and then let's say a brown. So that would be like 330, and it would be mostly always in micro Henry. So you see something like that, or let's say first one silver, second one, let's say gray, gold, and how about red? And then that would be, again, 8.2, the gold indicating the decimal point. So that's what you'll see on a lot of these ones that you see on the circuit boards from the older ones going back maybe 10, 12, 15 years ago, where the boards, you know, had, they're all, no surface-mounted stuff in those days, sticks, those old VCRs and all, TV sets, everything, you know, stood up on a board, and you unsolder it from the bottom, over.
Yeah, we're glossing over something here, which maybe you've covered in earlier sessions, and maybe you've covered it by the written answers you've given to the people who have sent you emails, but the process of removing a printed circuit board component is itself a little bit of an art form. In some cases, you can pick up a substance sold by Radio Shack called solder wick. It's a copper braided material that you hold it up against the soldered joint, put the soldering iron on top of this solder wick, and you melt the whole process, and the solder wicks itself into this braided material and removes itself from the joint. That's the inexpensive way. The guy who is rich as all hell can buy a solder sucking machine. And now I do remember, you did describe this handheld object that would suck up the solder. So yes, I guess you did cover the subject. So once the components are removed from the board, they can then double check it with an ohm meter, confirm that because of a very small number of ohms, it's most likely a RF choke or an inductor, and therefore they can be using that in other circuits at a later time. Is that approximately what you're advocating here, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Oh, yes, they've been having a grand old time taking things off the board using the solder sucker. They sell one very cheap. It's a little pump, and it sells for about $6. You just spring-load it, a little button to release, and you heat up the connection. They've been practicing. Put it over there as you're heating it with the little iron, and pops the solder right away, and the device comes off the board very easy. So they've been having a grand old time doing that. One was telling me how proficient he is. He stripped down just about, he told me this board, he's got hundreds of components, been sorting resistors and capacitors and everything, and he says, I'm going to have a whole supply of things, and I'm waiting to get started on my project this winter of making all kinds of different little devices that you found, that I found in a book, sold also, called, Engineering Notebook, but, you know, it's put out by Archer, and it's a very interesting book. They have at the Radio Shack. It has a lot of nice little devices to make oscillators, blinking lights with LEDs and all, and a lot of fun, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think there's a number of Radio Shack books that used to be sold, and maybe they still are, 101 Circuits. There are a number of books sold on Amazon, among other places, of The Wicked Genius or something like that is the name of the series of books, which show you some very interesting circuits you can build once you've got a reasonably good supply of parts. And these circuits can make sounds, blink lights, make particular waveforms on an oscilloscope, and that combined with operational amplifiers, and I know you haven't gone there yet, but it's something to look forward to, can do some real magic. Wesley had a question on what we've been discussing so far. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I'm always confused because after I hear the commercial from the repeater in CW, I almost never hear the confirmation that the signal sending that the repeater recycle. Most of the CMD devices, they have digits, the numbering on it, 103, 105, whatever. And what I've noticed is, of course, I believe Eric is going to correct me in this area, but most of the resistors are very easy to recognize, and instead of colors, you have 103, so that 10 is the number that states about the value, and the 3 is the number of zeros after that, so it's very easy to recognize. And then what I've noticed is the capacitors, they have a different color than the resistors. So now, as far as the coils, well, I was playing with my Van Keer magnetic analyzer, and actually I found out that every component has every value possible. You take the resistor, it has capacitance in it, and inductance in it, and you can say that about the coil and the transformers, anything. If you want to try to really find out what is that you keep having in your hands that is so tiny, it's really hard to do it. Unless somebody educated me in this area. And I forgot I have another question when my time comes. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, as soon as we're going to finish our beginner section, we'll be back to you, Wesley. But I think one of the things you're recognizing, if you've got an LCR meter, and some of the LCR meters, you can command what frequency it does the measurement as. You can ask it to do the measurement at 0.1 megacycle, 1 megacycle, 100 megacycles, and so on. And so even a small fixed resistor, if you measure it at a higher and higher frequency, you will get a slightly different value, because depending on the physical layout of a component, every component has a small amount of stray inductance. Every component has a small amount of stray capacitance. And as you go to higher frequencies, the stray capacitances and inductances start becoming more dominant, and you get a different value. And that's the real world.
And don't forget about the voltage. You can keep the same parameters changing the voltage, and you've got to get different results.
In the case of a magnetic transformer, you're absolutely right. As you start pouring current through a transformer, if you were measuring the inductance of the primary winding, and if your instrumentation has the ability to pour current into that primary winding, it creates partial saturation of the magnetic core, if it has one. That in turn changes the apparent permeability of the core, and therefore the measured inductance will decrease. Again, that's the real world. So, yes, most capacitors will give you the same number of microfarads at a range of voltages that it's rated for, although some of them change a little bit. Most resistors, as you start pouring current through them, if they heat up a little bit, will have a slight change in resistance. So nothing in this world is pure. But still, if you're smart enough, all of these are very useful components. Let me go back to Mel now. I know we're getting a little off subject. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2ARQ with a question after everybody's finished.
WA2ARQ. Tell me your name. Is your question with reference to the subjects that we are discussing up till now, or you want to be added to the list? And if so, you'll be after Wesley. ARQ, what is your name, sir?
Okay, Dick. The question is about ERP.
Okay, we'll be discussing ERP right after Wesley, but right after Mel. Mel first. K2KEY, you got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, let's stay with what we're talking about. So you're going to find these little inductors, and on the, especially the older VCRs and all, there was a lot of them sticking on the board, these little axial leads. Some of them stood up and all. And if you do measure ones, they have very low resistance. If there's little coils in there, there's wire in there. Put them aside, and we will go through identification of those in the future. As was mentioned, yes, nice instrument for you to have next. If you see it sold, and I saw sometimes at the ham fest, they've been selling these. I pick up these old bubble pack instruments. They were selling BOM and little LC meters and all for about $7 or $8 a piece, under $10. I saw a number of them. So if you would like to buy a next instrument now after your BOM, look for an instrument that's marked LC and possibly R. Some of them are just LC. In fact, you can find sometimes just one. I have one that's a nice little capacitance checker that has little buttons on it. Let me let it drop. And in fact, it just has different ranges that just reads out on the readout for capacitance. And it was a very reasonably priced instrument that I picked up, and it's very handy just to have around just to confirm that the capacitor value, you know, close enough. We call that the tolerance. It don't have to be exactly, if for instance, you know, it's off, say, a few percent from the color code, let's say, if it says like, let me give a quickie on like a capacitance, say it's 4.7 TF, if you read it like, or read, say, 120 TF, 121K, and you've got 118 PF or something, or 123 PF, that's acceptable. We call that tolerance. So if you see something like that, a capacitance instrument around, or one that's an LC-type instrument, and it's reasonable price, another thing that you're going to add to your little laboratory, and we're going to... show you in the future when you start making these circuits up how these little instruments, how these instruments and all are going to come in handy. This is going to set up a little shop. The next instrument, I could say, will help take your shop to the next stage, and you'll be amazed at all the little projects you're going to build. And yes, oh yes, you did mention, somebody did mention that they got a lot of these units that were being discarded, you know, TV sets are going out for the garbage, and the VCRs are going out for the garbage, and they found, yes, they have a lot of applications. You can make a lot of things with the remote control hand units, and so hold on to them also. Pretty amazing little devices there. So I think that's about the best that we can tell you right now for these devices. We'll pull it all together in the next week to come. Yes, transistors are seem to be quite a number of questions what to do with the transistors. So everything you're taking off the board, just sort it out, whatever you can, sort out, and put it in little boxes or however you I find. In fact, very easy to sort out, something very convenient. There's all kinds of little plastic dishes that cream cheese, I mean, that things like cream cheese, there's egg cartons that have a lot of little containers and things in there, all kinds of little containers, you know, that are around, and you can sort out the parts. Now, with the resistors, you can sort them. If you want to start sort them with values, just like the capacitors, separately sorted by values, and you want to take it to that point. The stuff that you're not sure of, like the inductors and all, if you can't read it, you understand it, just put them aside. So bit by bit, you'll be putting yourself together a little number of devices, and the integrated circuits and everything, I know they're not going to have a heck of a lot of applications, a lot of them, except the ones that, like, for the audio output integrated circuits and all. Some of them will be able to be used for simple amplifiers, audio amplifiers and all, and things like that. So we'll continue with this as I get the emails, and I'll try to bring up whatever is of interest from your emails. So keep them coming. Let me know how you're making out, and to Tommy especially, who's elected leader of the group. It's a whole class. They're all 10 years old, and they are getting together. They formed a club, Electronics Club, Dick, over.
Well done, Eric. Is this Electronics Club in the area of Brooklyn, somewhat close to your QTH?
That would be in the Bronx.
Okay, it's in the Bronx. Very good. All righty. Hopefully, these guys will suddenly become interested in electronics, and your and my case, the hobby of ham radio and our exposure to electronics and wireless electronics in particular became the career. It became our reason for existence, our raison d'etre. And you and I have been wrapped up in the subject for an awful long time, and that's what people are hearing about as we give these descriptions. Believe it or not, there was a TechNet yesterday afternoon. I'll give you a four-sentence description here. Let me drop. My son passed his comprehensive exams for the master's degree in RF electronics that he's studying. And so we had a little bit of a celebration. We went to Bethpage State Park, and it turns out that we chose the exact same day that the Lilac Group has their yearly picnic at Bethpage State Park. LILOG stands for Long Island Linux Users Group, those people who really like Linux freeware programming for their computers. And so my son was the vice president of that group quite a few years ago, very familiar with those people. So they held a get-together of about 15 or 20 of their people, and we were in the exact same Bethpage State Park picnic area. And so we had one great big conference of my son, our family, and friends, and the Lilac Group. And pretty soon, one of the guys in the Lilac Group is a ham radio operator, found out who I am and what I do, and we started asking questions back and forth, and for the next 2 hours, we had a technical net, believe it or not. You know what? It sounded very similar to this one, except that it was all face-to-face in Bethpage State Park yesterday. Unusual, but kind of fun. Okay, let me drop for a second. I've been hearing stories about Wesley going over to New Jersey with people guiding him in as if they had a global positioning satellite receiver to find an electronics dealer that had a spectrum analyzer and a waveform generator. And Wesley apparently ended up with more exotic pieces of instrumentation to be added to his laboratory. So I think he's going to be telling us a little bit about that. I am curious as to which model number of Hewlett-Packard spectrum analyzer he acquired. I think he said that the signal generator, pulse generator he acquired was an 8082 Hewlett-Packard. I've used that particular instrument. Beautiful instrument. It gives you any rep rate and any pulse duration you want, and positive and negative pulses, and DC offsets, and nanosecond rise times, and slow, fast, whatever. Boy, it can make some very interesting waveforms for controlling various kinds of circuits. So let's find out how your laboratory is going, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is N2XJN. First, I would like to thank you, W2GM. John, he was the person who actually was working as a GPS for me from the Staten Island, and he was helping me to get to the dealer 12 o'clock during the night time. I've got this that beat, and I actually I've got that instrument that was 3585A spectrum analyzer. from 20 hertz to 40 megahertz, and that was actually what I was looking for, although many people would say not much of use. Well, the project that I'm working on works on 20 kilohertz, so it's an extremely low frequency. And I called this person, actually, he answered to the email and he told me that I can pick it up. So I said, okay, how about instead of me picking it up very next day, let me do it tonight. And he said, okay. So I got beautiful help from the ham radio community, and I end up in some kind of catering in nearby the place of the guy, and the guy actually came for me, and he actually showed me the way to his house, and we start to talk. When he saw what I was doing, and then I showed him a few images of what I'm doing, he said, you know what, let me make the contribution to your project for free. And the contribution was 8082A, the post generated by Hewlett Packard. Can you believe that? It's in a beautiful shape, and I have a question about that, but that is going to be next time. Back to you for now, Dick, and to Exchange Listening.
Yeah, I'm finding out now that what you've got for the spectrum analyzer is an Agilent 3585A, 20 hertz to 40.1 megahertz spectrum analyzer, and I see that it comes down to a resolution of 0.1 hertz. That tells me it is not using conventional filters. This is a so-called ubiquitous analyzer. You got a goodie here. The ubiquitous analyzer, which, by the way, this particular dealer that I've got on page here, which, who is this? Valutronics. He wants to sell it used for $1,300. What I'm getting at is that this is a so-called ubiquitous analyzer. In other words, it does use digital signal processing. It takes the input signal, does an analog to digital conversion, operates on that signal. You can then select what resolution bandwidth you want, what filter factor, and you can select a whole lot of things if I understand this correctly. It's somewhat similar to a another machine that I've used from Hewlett Packard. Huh. 3583. I'm trying to think of the model number of the one that I've used, and I've really wanted one of those instruments. This ubiquitous kind of an analyzer. There are times when you want to suck a known sinusoidal signal out of the noise, where these things can really do magic. That's a fun machine. So let me pass it back to you and see if I've got the right instrument. N2XJN, K2RIW.
This is N2XJN for a group of people on the TechNet. Yeah, this is 3585A, and yes, it does have internal oscillator, and it locks on it. I can choose the start frequency, the stop frequency, the reference level volts, and the CF step size. What is CF? I have no idea. I'm just learning it. I didn't play with it so much because I was repairing elements that is usually not repairable. When I've got this analyzer, it was switching off after a certain period of time from the overheating. There was a beautiful overheating circuitry in it, and the fan was not working. So what I did is, the fan is a huge one. I took the fan out. I disassembled all of the bearings. Believe me, small, very tiny, very difficult, got inside that fan, 30 volts fan, huge one, and found one cold soldering. The coil looks a little bit funny. It was like a dual coil. If you picture the coil of the transformer with one lead in the middle exactly. So that in the middle was actually called soldering. I soldered it, I put it together and worked beautifully. The problem that I have with this is the CRT is weak. I can see everything, I can read everything, but it's not that strong. So I'm going to have to change the CRT. So far I don't have the exact model number. But people were telling me to deal with the voltage. The problem with that is that the instruction is not very much accurate. And what it says is go to the high voltage block. After you remove the cover, you got to remove the PCB board, put it on the extension, and then play with it through the extension cable. So I gave up. I'd rather change the CRT for it. I found one for $23. I just do not know whether this is the particular one, because there is another one, 3586 or 80 something, which actually that CRT was for.
KC2YAJ.
KC2YAJ. Please start off your name, sir. If you've got some information to contribute to what Wesley is discussing, please go ahead and do so. If not, we'll add your name to the list if you've got a question. There's one person ahead of you named Vic. KC Kilo Charlie 2 Yankee Alpha Juliet is what I've heard. Please correct me and start off with your name. My name is Dick, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. This is Greg, and it's KC2YIJ. That is correct. And I'm in the Bronx, and I'm listening to the conversation, and I do have a question, so I will wait for my turn. It is related to this issue, so be headed for this.
Very fine, Greg. Your signal is a little bit noisy. If so, anything you can do to give us a little bit more RF when we come back to you would be good. And because your signal was noisy, I'm not quite sure. Is your suffix of your call letters Yankee Alpha Juliet, or is it Yankee India Juliet? Back to you, Greg.
Suffix is Yankee India Juliet. Yankee India Juliet. Go ahead.
Very fine, Greg. We got you right. Let me drop for a second. Wesley, by my standards, you are a true European. A typical American throwaway society person would say, oh, the fan is defective. I'll throw it away. I'll go out and buy another one. A true European takes the fan apart, takes the bearings apart, gets down through the individual wires of this what's called a brushless DC motor is what you're describing. It's got two sets of coils at right angles to each other, or maybe more than two sets of coils. And there's some fancy electronics that fires those coils. And you found the cold solder joint and fixed the fan itself and put it back into operation. Mel, Dick, and Wesley have something in common like with that. I'm in the process of fixing my favorite digital true RMS digital multimeter, which any reasonable person would say, write a check for $200 and buy another one. Well, I fell in love with this particular one, and I want to fix it, even though I haven't got a schematic diagram. So by my standards, you're a true experimenter, a true European, who actually gets down to nitty-gritty and repairs it and find out what's going on. Very educational process. Now, this particular analyzer, there's a model number very similar to it that I've used often. And I came very close to getting one, and I'm still, that's the one that got away as far as I'm concerned, one of these ubiquitous analyzers. You've got one that goes all the way up to 40 megacycles. I was going to get one that only went to 100 kilohertz, which is very good for analyzing audio system. Did I say 100 kilohertz? Yeah, I think it's 100 kilohertz. Let me drop. Hey, you've got a more elaborate version. That's a little bit disappointing that the cathode ray tube is dim. Once you own a good oscilloscope, there are ways you can hook your oscilloscope to do the display for you of the weak cathode ray tube as a temporary measure. I've done that on occasion. Of course, you want to really get the instrument back in full operation. I know where you're going. And so if you can get a hold of the service manual, because it's the Hewlett Packard, and I hear tell there are some extremely good websites you can go to where almost all of the Hewlett Packard manuals for past instruments are downloadable. By way of the microwave group, the list serve for the microwave group of guys that are headed by Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. If you go to the website of www.WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org, I think it is, you go to his website, sign up for his particular microwave list. I do remember a few guys indicating which website has every one of these manuals if you don't already have it. By way of the manual, you'll find out, you'll find out whether or not all of the high voltage power supplies are operating correctly. The quickest way a cathode ray tube will give you a dim response is because one of the power supply voltages for that cathode ray tube are not proper. So by way of your other instruments, you can measure those voltages. You've got a high voltage probe, and you can find out where there's supposed to be 25,000 volts on the anode of the tube. Is it really 25,000 volts, and so on. And so by measuring all those voltages, you'll find out, is the tube being treated correctly? And I think there's a 50-50 chance you'll find out there's a power supply problem. Hewlett Packard has in the past had a moderate amount of trouble with high voltage power supply failures for their cathode ray tubes on their early instruments. In fact, Hewlett Packard's very first oscilloscope, the model 150A, was their only real disaster. That particular instrument developed such a poor reputation for high voltage failures that they would no longer supply parts for it. They wanted that unit to die. They wanted it to be wiped off the face of the earth. Hewlett Packard is a company with an extremely high hit ratio, but nobody bats a thousand. And when it comes to the Hewlett Packard 150A oscilloscope, that was their one major loser, and it was a high voltage problem. So once you confirm that the power supplies are correct, let me drop. The only other way that the cathode ray tube would develop a dim picture is because it developed a slight leak and it's got some air in it. They call it gassy. Or because the cathode has run out of materials to boil off of its surface. And in some cases, putting a booster transformer on the filament of the cathode ray tube, on the gun assembly. If the filament's supposed to run on 6.3 volts, and you put 6.8 volts on it, some of the older cathode ray tubes will come back to life for a considerable length of time. Don't do that until you've done all other measurements. That's the last resort. You put a booster transformer on the filament winding of a cathode ray tube for the gun assembly to bring the cathode back to life. The good news is you'll get back to full brilliance and almost full operation. The bad news is it's a temporary measure. You're shortening the life. The life of a filament of a cathode ray tube or of a light bulb is heavily dependent on what voltage that's supplied to it. And it's at one time I've heard tell that the life of a filament is a function of voltage applied to the 1 over 12 power, the 12th power. In other words, a very small increase in voltage drastically cuts down the life of the filament under normal conditions. So don't do that until you've measured everything else. But you'll eventually get to the bottom of it. So as I see it, you've got at least two fallbacks. One, you can use another kind of display temporarily, and you'll be quite busy making sure that that particular cathode ray tube inside of that cabinet is being treated correctly. Now that you've got a good airflow, you've got to make sure that all the voltages are right. Remember, I've told you guys many times, whenever you troubleshoot any piece of equipment, whether it be ham radio or whatever, your very first step is to measure all of the power supply voltages. That's the very first step that you should really do, because if you didn't do that, and you...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you didn't do that, and you start troubleshooting the symptoms that you know about, you can be chasing your tail for a long time because a reference voltage somewhere in the power supply was not performing correctly. And it makes everything else go crazy. and you'll be chasing your tail. So your next step is to confirm that every one of those power supply voltages on every one of those power supplies is doing exactly what it's supposed to do within its tolerance. If a particular power supply is supposed to be 680 volts and you measure 683, that's